I never stop being surprised at how religion gets separated from life, how religion has one vocabulary and life has another, so that the terminology we use in songs and sermons on Sunday would embarrass the daylights out of us if we had to use it in the office or at lunch on Monday. Stained glass religion, I call it, because one of the functions of stained glass is to block out the world beyond our walls, to filter the harsh light of reality into muted and comforting colors. The sermon title is a question: shall religion be stained glass or clear? And that's an allusion to the fact that the old New England congregational churches preferred clear glass rather than stained. They knew all about stained glass and the beauty of it because they had come from England, and they knew the great cathedral windows at Salisbury and Winchester and Westminster Abbey. But they wanted to make a statement. They thought of light as a symbol for truth, and they wanted the light to come to them without any diffusion or distortion. So as the dedicatory prayer says in the plaque in the foyer, the clear windows in this room symbolize congregational insistence that we need not be afraid of the full, strong light, that even if it is bright, so bright that it's painful, so is truth sometimes. And we want truth, as the prayer puts it, we want the light of common sense, the light of honesty. Preachers often learn to use stained glass voices, not the ones they use at the checkout counter at the grocery store or while buying gas, but a special pulpit voice that may be sweet or sepulchral, ingratiating or Bible thumping, but it is not their real voice. It's what a good seminary professor of homiletics will refer to disparagingly to his class as a preacher tone. If we put together stained glass and a preacher tone, and here and there a cross and an open Bible, along with some organ music and a healthy dose of Bach, Beethoven, and Handel, we get the atmosphere that signals religion, an experience we have once or twice a week in a special building, quite different in almost every way from the life we lead elsewhere in the week. These are not bad things, and because they are so familiar, they make many of us feel good who go to church, but they do carry some risk. And the risk is that religion becomes one thing and actual ordinary life quite another thing, and the gulf may get so wide that they don't even touch one another. The words we use give us away. Imagine for a moment that you wonder what your new neighbor is going to be like. And someone who knows him says, well, I can tell you this, he's a righteous man. Wouldn't that scare you a little? Do you get the feeling that this is a guy you'd want to sit beside on a flight to Australia? I mean, doesn't righteous sound like someone who would have an almost abnormally well-thumbed Bible under his arm, who would ask all too quickly if you were saved, and who might ask you to join him in a public prayer over the airline dinner. Not bad things, you would say apologetically, just not my style. But suppose somebody said about your new neighbor, "Well, I can tell you this, he's a good man." Wouldn't that relax you? Given our prevailing sense that righteous people are stiff and churchy and judgmental, while good people are relaxed and warm and tolerant. We've known too many people, haven't we, who are pillars of the church on Sunday and pains in the posterior everywhere else. And we've known other people not thought to be religious, who are decent, kind, quick to forgive, generous, good people, we've said. People it's a joy to be around. This is not an inevitable dichotomy, of course. There are a great many devoted church people who are also good, in all the best senses of that word. But there are some, too many in one's lifetime, who have made the word religious sound artificial and calculating, not a word to describe the human fullness of life, the tragedy of it, just as much as the glory of it. I had an odd illustration a year or so ago of how narrowly some of us define the word religious. I had spoken at a funeral in this church, and two people made totally opposite judgments about what they heard. This won't make sense unless you know that I do not use a traditional funeral ceremony out of a book. I ask for help from the family in creating a sketch of a life that was like no other life, including even the eccentricities that were part of a real human being. If a funeral is a mix of tender tears and loving laughter, a celebration of an authentic life instead of a plaster saint, I consider it a success. It isn't an easy thing to get right. The choice of a single insensitive word could create the wrong mood. And because of that, I have sometimes envied the high church priest who opens, say, the Book of Common Prayer, fills a name in the blank, and reads the same phrases and same scriptures and same prayers over and over, no matter how many deaths occur in his parish in a given year. It is even more tempting to do that when I realize that the reiteration of those familiar phrases and prayers can bring their own brand of comfort to people who have grown up hearing them. They sound right. They sound religious. So I would do that kind of service, right out of the book, traditional language and all, for anyone who wanted it. But what amazes me is that what is religious is so narrowly defined at times by some people. After I had preached a funeral for a man, a friend of mine asked one of the relatives what she thought of the funeral. Well, she said, it was a non-religious funeral. And her tone of voice made it clear that it might just as well have been done in a wheat field. I had talked that day about the man's basic goodness, his love of family and friends, about the smooth and rough spots in his typically dear human life, and ended with a prayer asking that he be received into the love and mercy of God. But that was not enough. The familiar phrases had not rung out from the book, so it was not religious. Another relative, who incidentally belonged to the same high church, wrote a letter to me expressing gratitude for words that captured her uncle's life and gave comfort to all of her family. It had not occurred to her that our celebration of that life was not religious. So how do we define what is religious? Listen carefully. Is it religious for me to sing the old rugged cross, but secular if I'm only driving a ghetto child to a circus she would otherwise never see? A man leads prayer in church. At the same moment, a woman gets out of her car on Rock Road to cradle an accident victim's head in her arms. Is one of those acts religious and the other secular? Not according to my understanding of the life of Christ. I believe that a cup of cold water held to the grateful lips of someone dying of thirst is one way of worshiping the God of love. And I believe that a look from your eyes or a touch from your hand can be as eloquent a prayer as any you may ever speak or hear in a church. I came upon the perfect satire of this odd division between being religious and being good. An old Southerner from some novel or play, I've forgotten which, says, "Brothers and sisters, you know and I know that I ain't been what I oughter been. I've robbed hen roosts and stole hogs, told lies and got drunk, slashed strangers with my razor, and gunned the neighbors with buckshot. But glory be to God, there's one thing I've never done. I've never lost my religion." I think his neighbors would rather have that man good than righteous. Let me tell you a story about a man who knew the difference between being righteous and doing good. Some of you, you can confess this to me privately later, but some of you date far enough back to remember when Fiorello LaGuardia was mayor of New York City during the worst days of the Great Depression and through all of World War II. New Yorkers translated his first name and called him the Little Flower, a short, feisty little man, fearless, egotistical, champion of the people, a guy who used to ride the fire trucks, raid speakeasies with the police, and take entire orphanages to baseball games. When the newspapers went on strike, which was fairly often in those days, he used to go on radio and read the Sunday comics to the kids. I heard him do it. He was eccentric, as interesting people often are. One bitterly cold winter's night in 1935, the mayor turned up in a night court that served the poorest ward in the city, dismissed the judge for the evening, and took over the bench himself. In a little while, a tattered old woman was brought before him, charged with stealing a loaf of bread. She told LaGuardia that her daughter's husband had deserted her, that her daughter was sick, and that her grandchildren were starving. "I stole the bread to feed them. I'm sorry." But the shopkeeper, from whom the bread had been stolen, refused to drop the charge. "It's a bad neighborhood, Your Honor," he said truthfully. "She's got to be punished to teach other people around here a lesson." The mayor felt the force of that logic, so he sighed and turned to the old woman. "I've got to punish you," he said. "The law makes no exception. $10 or 10 days in jail." But even as he pronounced sentence, the mayor was already reaching into his pocket, and having pulled out a bill, he tossed it into his famous sombrero with these words, "Here's the $10 fine, which I now remit. And furthermore, I'm going to fine everyone in this courtroom 50 cents for living in a town where a person has to steal bread so that her grandchildren can eat. Mr. Bailiff, collect the fines and give them to the defendant." So the following day, the New York City newspapers reported that $47.50 was turned over to a bewildered old lady who had stolen a loaf of bread. 50 cents of that amount being contributed by the grocery store owner, while some 70 petty criminals, people with traffic violations, and New York City policemen, each of whom had just paid 50 cents for the privilege of doing so, gave their mayor a standing ovation. No sermon ever defined the meaning of goodness better than that moment in a dingy courtroom. Do you remember that our English word for God is the old Anglo-Saxon word good, which means good? God is love, a verse of Scripture says. What we say every time we speak the name is that God is goodness. They are, of course, ultimately the same thing. One more true story to remind you how real religion penetrates all of life. I had the great good luck to see the Elephant Man in New York City one evening years ago, and I will never forget the intensity of that marvelously acted play. Most of you know about the Elephant Man, either from the play or from Christine Sparks's biography of Joseph Merrick, the real-life Elephant Man. Merrick was a victim of neurofibromatosis, which is a disease that has no cure, and or had none then at least, and ended in hideous disfigurement, pain, and premature death. And on top of that, in late 19th century London, where Merrick grew up, the horror of that disease was made even worse by a widespread belief that it was the result of some sort of moral lapse, for which either the victim or his parents was responsible. When a certain doctor discovered Merrick working as a freak in a sideshow, he was barely able to speak, horribly deformed, so awful to look at that he wore a mask when he was not on display, and so crushed by the laughter of circus customers that he had withdrawn almost totally within himself. Dr. Trevis took Merrick under his personal care and got him accommodations at the prestigious London Hospital, to which the Prince and Princess of Wales came to pay him a visit, and to which money was sent so that this very intelligent young man could have books, a tutor, and lessons in crafts, and to which one day a woman named Madge Kendall came. Miss Kendall was one of the finest actresses and one of the most beautiful women of her generation. When she heard about Merrick, she was deeply moved and determined to do what she could to help. She made an appointment to visit, and when she arrived, she presented Merrick with a copy of the complete works of William Shakespeare. When the young man took the book in his hands, tears welled up in his eyes, and without a word, he began fumbling through the volume until he came to his favorite play, Romeo and Juliet. And then occurred what his biographer insists was the moment that began his return to humanity. Slowly, hesitatingly, in his high, squeaky, broken voice, he began to read aloud the speech of Romeo as he watches his beloved on the balcony. See how she leans her cheek upon her hand. Oh, that I were a glove upon that hand, that I might touch that cheek. Madge Kendall slipped into a chair beside him and began to respond from memory with Juliet's lines. And so as the afternoon shadows lengthened across the pages of the book, the two of them sat there side by side, reciting to each other until they had completed the whole second act of Romeo and Juliet. And then Madge Kendall reached out her hand and took the young man's grotesquely withered fingers in her own. Leaning over, she kissed his swollen, leathery cheek, and finally, ever so gently, she said to him, "Why, Mr. Merrick, you're not an elephant man at all. You are Romeo." From another book, here is the judgment on that moment and on all such moments. Everyone that loves is a child of God and knows God, for God is love. Amen.